This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There's the legend, the Sammy Davis Jr. we remember as a brilliant performer, Rat Pack member, a triple threat who acted, danced, and sang his way into showbiz history.
A buzzer took a monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on the square. A buzzer tried to throw the monkey off his back. The monkey grabbed his neck and said, "Now listen, Jack. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top."
And then there's the Sammy Davis Jr., the troubled star who could not straighten up and fly right, an African-American who endured both racism and the taunts of race traitor, the drug addict who abused his family, the businessman who fronted for the mob, the international celebrity who rubbed shoulders with princes and presidents. In a new book, Matt Birkbeck tells the story of Davis's remarkable and complex life through interviews with many people who've never spoken before. He tells the story not only of Sammy Davis Jr., but of Albert "Sonny" Murray, the lawyer who spent 7 years trying to restore his legacy. Later in the hour, there's no such thing as a pop quiz anymore. We'll tell you why. But first, Sammy Davis Jr., tell us how you saw this American icon. Entertainer, drug addict, civil rights campaigner, mobster. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blog of the nation. Matt Birkbeck is an investigative journalist. His new book is Deconstructing Sammy, Music, Money, Madness, and the Mob. He joins us from our bureau in New York. And nice to have you on the program today.
My pleasure.
And this book is about a lot of things, but begins with a mystery. How did a man who earned upwards of $50 million wind up dying broke and alone, except for his loyal bodyguard, while his wife and her people and his manager and her people took turns looting his house of jewelry and paintings?
Well, that was the mission here, to try to explain all of that. Sammy died in 1990. Which is 18 years ago already. And when he did die, he was $15 million in debt. And his wife, Altaviz, his estate was declared insolvent. His home was sold in Beverly Hills, as were his possessions. And his widow, Altaviz, ended up living in poverty in Pennsylvania, in the Poconos. And she was living on the property that was owned by the proprietors of the Hillside Inn, which is the oldest black-owned resort in the nation.
And really, you're telling the story of two families, not just Sammy Davis Jr. and his wife, Altaviz, but also the story of Albert "Sonny" Murray.
Correct. He was such an integral figure. You know, I heard about this story from Sonny Murray several years ago. I've known him for about 10 years. And he told me, I actually reported on it when he resolved the IRS situation. I reported on it, but didn't know anything about the story. And frankly, I didn't know anything about Sammy Davis Jr. other than what most Americans know and have seen on television. And I'd ask him over the years, you know, about his representation. He didn't really want to get into it. And I didn't know why at the time. I found out later. But he did give me little tidbits about Sammy, such as Sammy had ties to the mob, or Sammy knew who was involved in, or said he knew who was involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And obviously, as a reporter, I'm intrigued, and I want to know more. And it wasn't until Sonny Murray's father passed away in 2005 that he started to open up. He started to tell me more about his own family and about how his family was actually involved in this remarkable story. And I just said to him, "Hey, I have to tell this story. It's such a great story." He didn't necessarily see it. At the end of the day, he trusted me. And as the story comes together, Altaviz is living in Pennsylvania. Sonny, who's a former federal prosecutor who gained fame in the 1980s, he's the guy who took down E.F. Hutton, the great financial services giant. And he spent 3 years on that investigation. So now he agrees to take on the Sammy Davis Jr. case. Altaviz ends up in, she ends up in Pennsylvania living with a fellow who was friends with her father, who was living in New York. And Altaviz has, she's got issues with alcoholism. She has no money. She remains virtually a recluse in a room for 2 years. So the fellow she was living with, Calvin Douglas, begs Sonny to take the case. He takes it. and they place Altuve's in rehab, and he begins his own journey. It takes him 7 years to try to not only resolve this great IRS debt that most people told him in Los Angeles it could not be done. You're not going to be able to do this. He also takes on the mission of restoring Sammy Davis Jr.'s legacy. Because of the IRS debt, no one wants to do business with the name Sammy Davis Jr.
It takes enormous negotiations and indeed another mystery story resolved to even get out the great retrospective Rhino Records boxed set of Sammy Davis's career. That couldn't happen until after the IRS debt is resolved. But your book is replete with stories of film deals and proposed Broadway productions of Sammy Davis's life, all these things that never, ever happened because all of his people couldn't get their act together. His family was tearing at each other, and this just went on and on and on.
It's such a tragic story. There was so much distrust within his own family, particularly between his third wife, Altuve's, and his children, who didn't like what was going on in his personal life. You know, they knew little about their father. You know, Sammy, as great as he was probably the worst father of all time. Neglected his children, wouldn't see them for months, wouldn't send them Christmas cards, banned his son from a tour.
There's a story you tell about his daughter was about to graduate from college, the greatest day of her life, and he calls and says, well, do you really want me there?
Correct. And he's, you know, if you really want me there, I'll charter a plane and I'll come. And she was crushed. That's his daughter. That's his daughter, Tracy. Who happened to be, you know, she turned out to be a great source for this book. You know, the kids, his family, you know, very distrusting, not just within each other, within the fabric of the family, but also of the media, you know, of other, you know, there have been several books that have been written about their father. They saw where I was going with this story in terms of trying to get to the bottom of what happened to their father, as well as following Sonny Murray's work. And they were all very cooperative and very helpful.
We're talking with Matt Birkbeck about his new book, Deconstructing Sammy, Music, Money, Madness, and the Mob. Call us and tell us how you remember Sammy Davis Jr., 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Jerry's calling us. Jerry with us from O'Fallon in Missouri.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm just responding to the part of the teaser opening about fronting for the mob.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a lot of people understand, going back to the 1920s, the people who, black people who broke into what was essentially the white entertainment world, like Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, all had people that took a large percentage of their earnings and, whether covertly or outright, were connected. And that was the only way, really, that you could get ahead or even gain a foothold in the entertainment world. And even, you know, most performers would tell you that, you know, from the 30s until the 50s, most of the major nightclub venues that they worked at were, you know, again, whether discreetly or overtly owned by the mob.
Well, Matt Birkbeck, that's certainly the picture you describe of Las Vegas when Sammy Davis Jr. was one of the biggest headliners there.
Sammy's entree into the mob occurred back in the 1950s through Frank Sinatra, and it lasted up until his death. The mob, I was told, you know, I interviewed several FBI agents who were involved in different investigations, particularly the big one that all but erased the mob's hold over Las Vegas and the skimming operations they had there in the 1970s. The film Casino, the Martin Scorsese film, is about that. They told me that Sammy and Sinatra were considered two of the mob's biggest earners for their ability to bring people to Vegas, that many more people, more than any convention that would come to town. And with all those people in town, it just reaped millions for the mob in terms of the skim. And they were that valuable. They also used Sammy, unfortunately, they used his good name to entice investors into bogus deals, business deals, fried chicken, gourmet quails, you know, really ridiculous notions.
That
people would invest in because they saw Sammy's name was attached to it. Perhaps the biggest and the one that actually really ruined him in terms of business deals was his tax shelter, in which Sammy It actually went to the U.S. tax court, and it was a venture in which people would invest. It was for tax sheltering purposes, and it was supposed to be a project that was going to take coal out of Kentucky, and you were going to put the coal into 10-pound bags and sell it to American consumers to heat their homes. It was a ridiculous notion. And the U.S. tax court in 1989 saw it for what it was, in very clear language, said it was a fraud. And because of that decision, they upheld an IRS decision in which Sammy owed $5 million to the federal government, which later ballooned to $7 million by the time Sonny Murray had resolved it. And that was the decision. When Sammy was diagnosed with cancer in 1989, they told him that they can remove his voice box, but of course you'd never sing again. And he opted instead, and you'd have it, and he would have had an 80% chance of survival. Instead, he opted for radiation and chemotherapy, which had a far lesser chance of survival, knowing that if he couldn't sing, he couldn't earn. If he didn't earn, he'd end up bankrupt, and he did not want to end up that way.
Well, more to the point, he said, if I can't sing, I'm not Sammy Davis Jr.
Correct.
Jerry, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And as it went ahead, he was mobbed up. Well, Sinatra was mobbed up, too, but to a different degree. Sinatra got better treatment.
Sinatra was treated like a king. And the best way I can explain this was a story that was told to me. As I mentioned earlier, the film Casino, that investigation there, it was headed up by a fellow by the name of Dennis Gomes, who went on to become the president of the Tropicana and the Golden Nugget. And he, in a previous life, was an investigator with the Nevada Gaming Commission. And Sinatra and Sammy, whenever they were in town, in addition to performing, they'd also would play with the high rollers. They would gamble. And Sinatra would play, and he'd lose, and he'd lose tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars, and he'd get markers, and he'd keep getting markers. Sammy would do the same thing. At the end of the night, Sinatra did not have to pay his markers. Sammy did. So even though Sammy was making $150,000, $200,000 per week, he gambled much of it away.
We're talking with Matt Birkbeck about his book, Deconstructing Sammy, Music, Money, Madness, and the Mob. Tell us how you saw Sammy Davis Jr. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We know Sammy Davis Jr. as a remarkable entertainer, member of the Rat Pack, close relationships with everybody from John Kennedy to Richard Nixon, also had ties to the mob, and when he died, the IRS valued his likeness at only $500. In his new book, Deconstructing Sammy, Matt Birkbeck writes about Sammy's relationship with Sam Giancana, his claims that he knew who killed John Kennedy. You can read an excerpt from the book at npr.org/talk. Matt Birkbeck is an investigative reporter, the author of Deconstructing Sammy, Music, Money, Madness, and the Mob. Tell us how you remember this American icon, entertainer, drug addict, civil rights campaigner, mobster. 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Denise. Denise with us from Cincinnati.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I just actually had a quick question, I guess. This seems like a really fascinating discussion. But I was always told, and I'm in my mid-20s and know absolutely nothing about Sammy Davis, so I will acknowledge that. But I'm African-American, and my mother always told me that in terms of like race traitor card, that he didn't identify as himself being black, but identified himself, aligned himself with Jewish people. And I don't know if that's true, false, what, but I guess I just wanted to hear his insight on that.
Well, Matt Birkbeck, Sammy Davis Jr. did indeed convert to Judaism.
He did, and he did have an issue with black America. And it wasn't that he didn't want to be black. His road to fame was placating white America. That was his audience. But as is demonstrated in the book, there were so many different scenes that show Sammy in which where race is such an important issue to him. You know, he was one of the first to break down racial barriers, or at least he tried to. He believed that his stardom would break down those barriers, which is why he believed in 1960 he had married the actress Mai Britt. He felt that it was something he could do.
Let me ask you to answer this question in terms of two kisses and a hug. The first kiss, of course, he called it the suicide scene in the famous play The Golden Boy.
I'm sorry, one more time?
Yeah, the kiss that he had on stage in the play on Broadway, he described it as the suicide scene.
It was because at the time, you know, times are different. Your caller there was, 20-something years old. And they don't know what it was like in the 50s. They don't know what it was like in the 60s and even in the early 70s. Even the kiss with Carol O'Connor in All in the Family made national headlines. You know, racial tensions, we talk about race today, particularly in these times with our presidential race. Racial tensions in those days, I mean, it was so far greater. It was like a new beginning in trying to get people to accept each other. And Sammy was at the forefront of that. Black America didn't know that. All Black America saw was Sammy doing things to pander to white society, when in fact, even behind the scenes, Sammy was very proactive in terms of, you know, there were scenes in the book where there's his stand-in is in Las Vegas and he's getting tossed out because he's black. Sammy sees it and he stops it and he gives him some money and says, go ahead, go gamble. There's another scene in the book where Sammy, and this is 1970, and his career was kind of on a downward spiral, and he's grateful for getting a job on TV. He was hosting it was a show called The Clowns, you know, with Gary Smith was the producer, a famous producer. And he does the show, and he has to go the next day to record some songs, and he looks out, and he looks into the studio, and he sees 30 white musicians. And he says, he turns to Gary Smith and he says, what's going on here? And Gary says, what? And he goes, you can find 1, 2, 3 black musicians. And he storms out. So those were his battles. Those were the ways for him to fight it. You know. And then also, he also did things like for Richard Nixon. He went to Vietnam to entertain the troops. He was very, very proactive. And I think as Black America reads this book, I've already heard from some reviewers from the black press, and they're stunned to see, you know, they're seeing a whole side of Sammy that they had never seen before.
You mentioned that, and Denise, thanks very much for the call. You mentioned that scene with Carol O'Connor in All in the Family. Carol O'Connor, of course, a good friend of Sammy Davis's. We have an excerpt from that famous broadcast.
Now, no prejudice intended, but, you know, I always check with the Bible on these here things.
Oh.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, if God had meant us to be together, he'd have put us together. But look what he's done. He put you over in Africa. He put the rest of us in all the white countries.
Well, you must have told him where we were, because somebody came and got it.
And the famous kiss of Carol O'Connor, of course, shocked Archie Bunker, the character. But the kiss, the embrace, the hug of Richard Nixon at the Republican National Convention in Miami, 1972, that shocked a lot of black Americans.
It infuriated them because of what the Republicans stood for at the time. But what they didn't know, and I actually subsequently found out more about this after I finished the book, is that Sammy, as well as Sinatra, they had been very supportive of Democratic candidates, particularly the Kennedys in the early 60s. Their ties to organized crime led them to support Richard Nixon, who had the support of organized crime, and particularly had the support of the Teamsters Union. And it's the Teamsters Union in which Sammy's ties are really interesting and somewhat intricate.
Let's get John on the line. John with us from Lake Tahoe.
Hi.
Hi, John. Go ahead, please.
I knew Sammy personally. I was a stagehand working up at Tahoe when Sammy was performing, and he was very kind and considerate, considering I was nobody. And he took me golfing, and we had food like breakfast together, spaghetti for breakfast, things like that. And because we had a mutual hobby of photography, and he was so outgoing with everyone, and yet he could understand his attempt, as was previously described, placating the white man, and yet he was not racially motivated, as, let's say, you know, at that point there was a lot of black issues going on with power, and he was trying to avoid that, and yet he was always humble in the background, and I appreciated that from him.
John, thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we can go now to, this is Tony. Tony's with us from Kent City in Missouri.
Yeah, it's Tony Paul, and I met Sammy several times. I was the first black in the Las Vegas Folies Bergères in 1980-81, and Sammy and his beautiful wife, I'm shocked to hear what's happened to him. I've always wondered what's happened to her, but we always managed to get in touch with each other, whether if I was in Vegas. After that, I went from Reno to Paris and worked in the Moulin Rouge there, and Sammy was there doing a benefit for UNICEF, if I remember. And I remember all these stories, too, while I was working in Vegas, that your the author had spoke about, whether it be the one where he did walk out with the because there wasn't any black musicians. I know that one. So these are all, I'm just shocked to hear what's happened to Old Trevise. That's amazing. I've always wondered. I remember in 1990, I was in Germany and was wondering what happened to what was going to happen to her. I didn't know he was broke. I'm shocked.
Yeah, one of the subplots of your book, Matt Birkbeck, is why Albert Sonny Murray continues to represent Alta Vista, given that she relapses many, many times with alcohol and deceives him.
You know, Sonny, like the rest of Black America, particularly, you know, he grew up in the 60s. He was a child of the 60s. He didn't like Sammy Davis Jr. either. When he took on the case, when he met Alta Vista, first, he felt great empathy for her. Second, he did feel that, you know, this was a great legacy that needed to continue on. So, but he didn't know anything either, and he just and he's finding out new details about Sammy, whether it was finances or associations, and he's continuing on and on. You also have to understand where Sonny comes from, and that his parents, and they play a big role in this story, and deservedly so. His father was the first black judge, criminal court judge in Brooklyn, New York. They came from the South up to New York City, and his mother, and they opened up the Hillside Inn, his mother, Odetta, who everyone called Mama, who becomes very friendly with Alta Vista in the 1990s and actually considers her a daughter. These are good people. You know, they believe in goodness, and they extended themselves to Alta Vista and believing that they were, you know, Sonny was on a mission here. He thought, again, like I told you earlier, he prosecuted E.F. Hutton in the 1980s. The more he finds out about what happened to Sammy, the angrier he becomes. And he believes he's on a mission to rectify a great injustice. And it's not till the very end, unfortunately, when Alta Vista turns on him, that he realizes that he expended a lot of energy, a lot of time, and a lot of money. And, you know, you have a story about goodness, and then you have a story about the dark underbelly of Hollywood and what happens to people who, unfortunately, get involved with that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm just shocked, and Mr. Birkbeck, your book, I'm glad you wrote it because it helped someone like me who just had no idea that was going on or anything. I thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you. And if I might add, real quickly, you know, we're talking about Sammy and the mob and drugs and whatnot. You know, he was arguably the greatest entertainer of the 20th century. And it's important for young people to know this because they really don't have any idea who Sammy Davis Jr. is.
Because his estate was so horribly mismanaged.
Exactly. And so he's, you know, he's a footnote to history. To this day, the estate is still insolvent. A federal lawsuit was filed earlier this year. There's a whole other cast of characters that are involved. It's just, it's a tragic situation.
One last call. Brad's with us. Brad calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Matt, I'm wondering, this might sound like a stupid question, but I'm wondering if Sammy Davis Jr. had not played in the white man's world, would he have been as popular as he turned out to be?
No, absolutely not. It was because of that entree. It was because of Frank Sinatra. It was because of the Rat Pack. It was because of his acceptance. Actually, because Frank Sinatra accepted him, everybody else accepted him. And he had the talent to begin with. Again, as I said, he was probably the greatest talent of the 20th century. He was a triple threat who can do anything and everything. And if you've never seen him before, you know, just go to YouTube and download one of his clips and you'll see. But without the support of white America, I mean, you can think of Barack Obama today. If he doesn't get the support of white America, he's not going to be president.
Right.
Same thing with Sammy Davis Jr. He doesn't get the support of white America, he's not going to be the entertainment icon.
Matt, thank you very much. Look forward to reading your book.
Thanks for the call, Brad. Here's an email from John in St. Louis, Missouri. I played for Sammy several times at the Fox Theater in St. Louis in the early 1980s. I found him always to be very friendly and nice to the musicians in the orchestra. He was very easy to talk with off stage. However, the musicians that traveled with him always said he was very cheap with respect to paying them, and he did not pay them very well, even though he, Sammy, was making a lot of money. We found out we were making a lot more money than the guys in the band that traveled with him. And that's unusual. I thought he treated
Sammy, again, with all these, you know, the stories of Sammy that we're talking about here, not only was he a great entertainer, he was quite, and friends, these are people who never spoke before. His former publicist, David Steinberg, who represents Robin Williams today, Brian Dello, his chief security guard. Sammy was one of the most generous people who ever walked the face of the earth. I mean, there's one scene in the book where he's buying Chinese food for an entire airliner because they're stuck on the tarmac for 4 hours.
Here's just an email just on that point. Betty in Chester, California. I worked for Harrah's Lake Tahoe in the early 70s. Sammy Davis often played the South Shore Room. I went to see him several times. Always a great show. Once when he came, he missed a couple of shows because he was ill, according to one of the waiters. The night Sammy came back, he got through about half the set, then took a break. He came back out, announced he wasn't well and wasn't giving the kind of show he ought to give, apologized because he couldn't finish the show, and picked up the tab for all the dinners.
That was Sammy.
Matt Birkbeck, thanks very much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
Matt Birkbeck, the author of Deconstructing Sammy, Music, Money, Madness, and the Mob. He joined us from our bureau in New York. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.